All right, you have one verse of Scripture, one handout today. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Romans 1:21. DOT. Cause. Or as the invitation, George Bush, Will Ferrell, on Saturday Night Live says, cuts. Cause what? Nontes. In your own experience, and he's talking to the whole world, anthropon. Earlier verse declared, not Adam, not ethnos, ethnics, not Jew, everybody. Anthropon, from which we get anthropology. Mankind, all of it. The wrath of God is revealed. That's already written up there in red letters. Apocalyptitai, out from being buried or covered or veiled. The wrath of God, slow boil, orgy, from heaven, is being present and continuing, is being revealed from heaven against all possum, epipossum, all Asavian ungodliness, kai adikion unrighteousness. And he starts a series of reasons. Last Sunday we camped out on the footprints of God in nature. Natural revelation. What's available to everybody? I have a circle here. As Paul's logic and argument will proceed, he starts with 1:18, against all, the wrath of God. And then he starts talking to mankind in general apart from any special revelation. They are still the subject. You that have revelation are included also. But apart from special revelation, without the knowledge that you and I have and have been blessed with, they're still without excuse. Because God left His footprints in the creation. The handiwork demands the craftsman, is Paul's argument. Well, now, will everybody agree? Hell no. Why do you say hell no? Because that's where they'll find out. Because. Not everybody agrees. God always manages to send along to me by some miraculous delivery system that gets my attention. It's really nice to know that the L.A. Times can be moved by God. I mean, I've not been too happy with the tenor, and I'm sure that this will make their paper tremble. But I've not been too happy with the editorial frame of reference on religion that seems to seep through every week as they do exactly what this book by Houston Smith says the media has become. And most of the books they review are aimed to sort of discount and discourage the old-fashioned, traditional faith in the supernatural, if it is Christianity. If it's somebody else, they'll feature them pretty openly, that I'm talking strictly about the book reviews. There are other articles that I give them credit for honestly portraying things. One just this week on a Latin American Bible school. But to my surprise, they reviewed a book I like. And exactly at the time I needed it. I don't know how it went by me because I know about his world religions. But this professor up at the northern half of our state at Berkeley has long been, son of Chinese missionaries, long been recognized as a world expert on world religions. And he has written this book that I camped out on at the end of my message last Sunday, Why Religion Matters, by Houston Smith. We camped out on his little discourse on light at the close of last Sunday's message. And I asked the question, in the vein that God left his footprints for all to see, but to those of us in the revelation frame, if I can go sideways for a moment, isn't it interesting if we adopt the modernist view that these books are written by men with no divine, supernatural urgings of any kind, that they're an accumulation in the Judaic world of similar legends in all the ancient cultures. Now, your a priori frame of mind will determine your reaction to that stance. As I've told you in the past, during my PhD at Stanford, I had prepared to do a PhD in geography at Cal. By what I now look back and see are God-ordained steps, I ended up at Stanford with a scholarship. And since I had prepared to do a PhD in geography, and the PhD at Stanford required a full unit minor, which was a whole year of work. I looked at all of their geography classes, and I felt I'd had everything. So I think, boggled their mind with a suggestion. I asked if I could get an opportunity to be credited a PhD minor in geography, my major being philosophies of education, by an oral exam. And they granted the wish, knowing I couldn't pass it. Because if I passed it, it wiped a full year out and freed me for a similar amount of units in another area. I passed it. And all of a sudden, now that's why I'm telling you that, all of a sudden the way was opened and I'm qualified to teach geography at the high school and junior college level and college level with a PhD minor in geography from Stanford, never having taken a course in geography at Stanford. I love to irritate them. But that gave me space to do a unit major in comparative religions. And that's where I was able to study and end up doing individual study with Dr. Kishimoto, who took Anasaki's place as the leading Buddhist scholar of the Far East, who was on a five-year sabbatical at five different universities here, Union Theological Seminary, Yale, Harvard, Princeton, and Stanford. And the fifth year of this series was at Stanford. So I was able to study Buddhism and Oriental religions under him. Spiegelberg, the head of the department, probably the world's leading scholar on Indian Vedanta and the roots of Buddhism, Asian religions. Ironically, he was a collector. He had the world's largest collection of Tibetan ghost traps. Weird. Weird and delicate creations to capture ghosts. And I grew up in that atmosphere of the religion of no religion, where there are many different paths to God. I was struggling with my own faith, finalizing and forming from a study of the resurrection. And so I have a background in the approach to the similarities between the creation stories and the flood stories and the religion of no religion, the academic frame, is these are myths in the proto-history subjective mind of all races. And all the Bible does is collect its version that can be paralleled with similar versions in other primitive societies, and thus no better nor worse than all these common myths circulating among the various elements of early mankind. Or you can take the other position, a priori, that the Bible record is the pure record, deliberately by the hand of God, directed in the choosing of a people that were chosen to be God's oracle, that which was a common experience in mankind might have his direct surveillance, guidance, revelatory help to keep the knowledge a pure stream versus the penumbria and added to and twisted expansions on the common memory base of all mankind. If the pure stream is correct, flowing from Adam, then all mankind would have these memory traces in their social psychological bag of memory passed on orally and ultimately written. But outside the direct oracle choosing supervision of God, they would meander and wonder and exaggerate and change, having similarities at their heart. But if you believe in the Bible as revelation, God, supervising it all, who knows that man, like the tree, grows from the root which is Adam, and that all mankind carries these subjective footprints in their memory bank, he chose a people that he might correct, reveal, and make clear and preserve the pure stream. That's a choice you make a priori. I didn't make it until I settled the resurrection. Once the resurrection founded my faith, once from hard study against all that is natural, I became convinced there's no other explanation. He came out of that grave. And I'll give the evidence again this Easter. Then he had what he claimed to have. It wasn't just anyone coming out of that grave. It was the one who made the ridiculous claims he made about himself. And when he verified, or had verified by God, his claims in the resurrection and ascension, then all of a sudden his use of the Old Testament stamped it with the authority that enabled me to make the a priori choice. This is the record guided by God. He chose a people that they might be light bearers. But if you adopt the other position, people who have said the resurrection is impossible, therefore it didn't occur, and anybody says it did has to be lying or a poor reporter or a gullible fool. And you set yourself above that which is being researched, and you conclude the Bible is just another book, like the rest of the books. It is the Jewish version of these various myths that are a part of the human memory bank. Then you will not take that word as prior, primary, first, authoritative, and thus you set yourself up to be the judge. But when you bow before the cross of Christ and the gospel record, confounded, astounded, and silenced by the truth of the resurrection and the reality of God's capacity now to use, express, and be that same power that raised up Christ from the dead to transform us from our path of imprisonment to the world, the flesh, and the devil, when you take His authority, then the Bible record becomes the authority. You do not approach it casually, and you look at this record as revealed truth. Now, what I've just said, which I've preached for years, which you grew up in, sets you apart from all this general anthropone, mankind, apart from special revelation. Starting cold, knowing nothing of Jesus. And if the wrath of God is on these people without excuse because of what is imprinted in the creation itself, how much more are you and I, with the knowledge of God's preempted, oracular revelation of truth that shows us the way out, out from the panoply of God's wrath outpoured? How, as the book of Hebrews says, shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation? But starting with the creation and the scientists I'm going to quote, they know the gospel story. So they've already shut their minds to it. But to answer the question, as I did, hell no. Does everyone who looks at the universe conclude the fingerprints, the handprints, the footprints of God are there? No, absolutely not. Give me a sample here. Let me give you a sample. How many of you ever watched Carl Sagan's series Cosmos? Certainly one of the greatest scientists of modern times. When Carl Sagan opened his television series Cosmos, he announced, "The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be." Now that flies flat in the face of, if ye were of the cosmos, the Greek word in Jesus' statement in the gospel, if ye were of the cosmos, King James translates world, but it's cosmos. If ye were of the cosmos would love its own. But ye are not of the cosmos. For I have called you out of the cosmos, therefore the cosmos hateth you. As I taught and read from C.S. Lewis on miracles, Your starting point determines your view on miracles. And the tragedy is, I'm going to say it with Henrietta Mears, who lamented that she could barely tolerate when progressive education experimentalism took over the secular schools and secular education. But then it was unbearable to see it seep into Christian education. I have that same feeling when most Christians are so brainwashed by the world of this century in which we live as a mindset, and that's what cosmos in the Greek really means. It's the mindset. I did a sort of pun in the quote, but cosmos is a frame of reference. What you take for granted, your view of things, the world's view of things. And there are just a few little cracks in the head for most Christians and periodic experiences where some of the mind of Christ leaks in. But most of you live enslaved in the mindset that is about to be described in this 21st verse. Even most of you and most of us who have revealed knowledge, when this verse is going against all mankind, including those that only have natural revelation, that which the creation hints at, doesn't say directly, hints at. Thus, if they're without excuse, how much more are we without excuse, living a life of ungodliness, which is non-awareness of God's presence with a sense of awe and worship about it, and falling short of His standard of righteousness, and not even living by faith, which gives us a doorway of righteousness that we can have. Living most of our life in ungodliness and unrighteousness in spite of revealed knowledge because of the mindset that presses in upon us from the world about us. This verse says, the wrath of God being revealed against you, all ungodliness and unrighteousness from heaven, this wrath is now being poured out. Cause, known taste, having known, ton theon, having known the God. And He's already said that in the previous verse. That the knowledge of God in creation is enough for God to say you're without excuse to not recognize the simplest thing about me, that I am and that I'm supreme. That there is a supreme being behind this, and as I started to say on miracles from C.S. Lewis, your starting point that the mindset of this world has robbed Christians of. If this cosmos, so you go back to Carl Sagan's use of the word, is all there is, all there ever was, all there ever will be, then miracles are impossible. What may look like a miracle is explainable with more knowledge of the workings of this cosmos. But if you believe that this cosmos, as Sagan called it, the universe and nature as a whole, which we haven't explored to the extremities of its vastness or to the extremities of its minuteness, but assuming that it will be more of the same, that's the whole ball of wax. That's all there is. And if that's your position, miracles are impossible. But if your position is this, which is the whole ball of wax, has indices within it I call footprints, handprints, fingerprints of a controlling supreme being, of a creator, of one that makes it not subject to chance. Indeed, that its very nature, when analyzed, cries out for the conclusion that it is derived, not self-contained, and that there is someone or something, some great other, that brought it into being, controls its destiny, can remove its being, and can enter into it by that other's choice to interfere at his will with natural processes, inexplicably from those processes, then that great other is a miracle worker. His reality and presence necessarily presupposed for the miracle to happen. Miracles are not something merely unexplained, not even merely unexplainable, because the naturalist believes as we increase our knowledge of this cosmos, we will be able to explain it. The spiritual believer, the biblical believer, and the right-thinking heathen stands in awe. This craftsmanship requires a crafter. And in awe before him, by their own feeble efforts, they will seek to be in right relationship with the craftsman. And to not do that, not have awareness of his presence and want to be right with him without even an understanding, just a knowledge, he has to be. God says, I'm fed up with your self-proclaimed deity, and therefore my wrath boiled up is being revealed. Why? Because the knowledge was there. And since the knowledge was there, having known the God, Edoxason, they glorified him not as God, nor Eucharistason thanked him, but became vain, the root. Matthias or Matthias means worthless, deceptive, deceived, became self-deceived, literally, in the reasonings, the dialogues, and the dialectics, because the word is the root for those, dialogue, desmois, in the reasonings of them, and their senseless heart, the very center of their being, was darkened. Now what Houston Smith does, and I may spend too much time with this book, don't expect to sit down and just read it like the comic books or like the comics. He very clearly, you're not going to have a collision, are you? He very clearly makes the point that the world has turned off on religion. And we, and he borrows from another author, that we live in a tunnel. That the world today that prides itself in so much knowledge has created a tunnel for itself. And I will try to scan sections of this because I believe he deserves the credit for his keen thinking, as he did on light. And I asked the question out of what he did, how, to pick up another strain earlier in this message, if the Bible is just a product of mankind, how then did they know? I mean, some of these other mythological religions given common standing by the mindset of today's modern world. How come the Bible record starts out with God first saying, He didn't say, man be. Well, I understand that. He'd be hanging in space. But He didn't say, sun be. He didn't say, moon be. Well, they are elements within the interconnections of light that generates this universe. He didn't say, grass be. They couldn't know what we know, that light, through photosynthesis, produces the grass. He didn't say, water be. He didn't say, dirt be, from which He's going to make Adam. He didn't say, noise be. His very first creative act, light be. Launching that which, as I quoted Einstein last Sunday, Einstein at one point said he wished he could spend the rest of his life contemplating light, the source of life. And as I read from Houston Smith, light is not synonymous with God, but light's everywhere God is. And light is the first instrument by which He created and by which He controls and balances the elements of this cosmos. All that is. Oh, they'd tell us everything started with the Big Bang. Did the Big Bang produce light? Light in itself. Inexplicable. Go to a encyclopedia and see how many pages and mathematical formulas conceived by geniuses fill those pages. God spoke, and there it was. And that was the beginning of recreation of the demolished earth that had become a waste and a desolation. How in the world did, if the modern view is correct, these primitive people, assembling legends, know to start with light? They didn't. God told them how He did it. That's revelation. We are beneficiaries of that. But the subject of these verses only have the creation. And God certainly has turned a generation over, because the crisis, He says, that the world finds itself in as it swings on the hinge of a new millennium. Am I going to bore you now? Is located in something deeper than particular ways of organizing political systems and economies. In different ways, the East and the West are going through a single common crisis whose cause is the spiritual condition of the modern world. My purpose in reading this is to show God's right. The world has become ungodly and unrighteous in all of their wisdom, and in anticipation of the verses to come, they are a living proof that God turned them over and gave them a push. That condition, we're going through a single common crisis whose cause is the spiritual condition of the modern world. That condition is characterized by loss. The loss of religious certainties and of transcendence with its larger horizons. The nature of that loss is strange, but ultimately quite logical. when with the inauguration of the scientific worldview, human beings started considering themselves the bearers of the highest meaning. Listen close. When human beings, at the inauguration of the scientific worldview, started considering themselves the bearers of the highest meaning of the world, human beings, and the measure of everything, human beings, meaning began to ebb, and the stature of humanity to diminish. The world lost its human dimension because we made ourselves God, and we began to lose control of it, the world that is. As I've said, the traditional revelatory view of the world and what God says, His footprints and fingerprints suggests enough that even the general world is without excuse in failing to recognize that the world, the cosmos as Sagan called it, is not freestanding. It derives from a divine source. And there are plenty of heathen civilizations to back up the ability to see that. Because this source is called Great Spirit, God, the One, infinite variety of names. I like His Spirit too. You say, well, did I come here for a bookkeep review? Yeah, it's a good one. I like His Spirit. He's a fighter. He says he takes a side road on sociobiologist E.O. Wilson's consilience as he's naming how the academic world tends to look down its nose at, I'll make it simple for you, at what I'm preaching today and what Paul was saying. Wilson's consilience. When I did read it, I discovered on page 286 that people follow religion because it's easier than empiricism, experimentalism, scientific method, hard work. And Mr. Smith says, that struck a nerve and provoked a response I shall be candid enough to report. Mr. Wilson, when you have endured an eight-day O-session in a Zen monastery, sitting cross-legged and motionless for 12 hours a day and allowed only 3.5 hours of sleep each night until sleep and dream deprivation bring on a temporary psychosis. When you've attended 4 rains retreats at the Insight Buddhist Meditation Center in Bear, Massachusetts for a total of 1 complete year of no reading, no writing, no speaking, and eyes always downcast. When you've almost died from the austerities you underwent before you attained enlightenment under a Bo tree in India, when you've been crucified on Golgotha, when you've been thrown to lions in the Roman Colosseum, when you've been in a concentration camp and held to some measure of dignity through your faith before the gas chamber hit you, when you have given your life to providing a dignified death for homeless, destitute women gathered from the streets of Calcutta, or played out her counterpart with the poor in New York City, when, Mr. Wilson, you've undergone any one of these trials, it will then be time to talk about the ease of religion as compared with the ardors of empiricism. You see, I, with Paul, in this section that I don't like to preach on, of the wrath of God, am still enjoying the opportunity to get on God's side and just be generally PO'd at the ignorance of the world. I told you what Christ my faith in university. It bears repeating. Respect, well-deserved respect from professors who would not speak on a subject until they had researched it thoroughly. I was the reader for Lou Oliver, head of the history department. He taught the general survey of history, including the Civil War. I went to him, writing a little term paper, and asked him a question, taking advantage of the fact that I had constant access with him as his reader. I said, "Dr. Oliver, can I ask you a question about Civil War?" And he sort of nodded in his taciturn way, and I asked him, he said, "Gene, I'm not an expert in the Civil War. That's Charles Scott's department. He's a U.S. history expert here. Go ask him that question." He wouldn't speak on a little issue in the Civil War because he didn't feel he had researched it adequately to give an authoritative answer. And yet these same professors looked down their nose and ridiculed and deprived me of my faith by the psychological pressure that I would never be accepted. With straight A's, I still would not get my academic wings until I abandoned a primitive faith in Jesus Christ and a belief in miracles. And I've told you the story of Lou calling me in. I was his reader, and he says to me, because he's puzzled, "Gene, I look at your grades, you're my reader, and I'm puzzled. I can't put together that academic work with your religious adherence to a belief in a supernatural Christ." "And I've concluded," he said, like a great relief washed over him, "that it's some psychological vestigial remnant of a connection with your father." And with that, I was dismissed as his best student with this little aberration of my vestigial psychological tie to my father. He taught the graduate class in historiography, where the pages uttered all the shibboleths that the Jesus Seminar is now putting out under the false impression of scholarship. Oral transition, not written until the third, fourth, second centuries. Thus, all the writers are pseudo-epigrammists who are lying in the first place, trying to add credence to what they're saying by claiming that they are these first century disciples and associates of Christ, when in fact this is oral tradition that's now being written 200 years later or more than that. I went back, you know, the textbook with Johnson. I went back, every textbook just belched out the same thing the previous guy said from the start of higher criticism in the 18th or the 1800s. And I began to probe and found a fault of all mankind. I don't care how academically honest you are, unwilling to speak on any subject without knowledge and looking at the facts, everybody is an instant fool on religion and politics. Everybody thinks they're born an expert in religion. And without even subjectively knowing it themselves, these professors, captured by their professors, in turn captured by their professors, with the worldview, passed it on with the same aura of professorial expertise that they were entitled to have in the areas where they were experts, but they knew nothing about Jesus. And that's my subject every Easter, the fact they call him a good and wise teacher. Proves they don't know a damn thing about the real Christ of history. And I again use the word cautiously, because you believe their nonsense, you will damn yourself. Reject Christ. Have the courage of the Jews of the first century, who recognized that for him to make the claims he made about himself, he was a blasphemer. But the resurrection makes you say, whoa! Whoa! He is what he said. It's only blasphemy if it's a lie. Have the courage to say what I said in the title of a series I've written. He's either a super nut or a fraud, or he's what he claimed to be. But the mindset of the world's in a tunnel. Scientism starts it. Scientism. What is scientism? The tunnel that the modern generation lives in has a floor, two walls, and a roof. And if you don't break out of it, you're captured. The floor, scientism, which supports the other three sides. This is the world we live in. Only four letters. Tism. Separate scientism from science. There is a big difference. There's not a war between the Bible. There's not a war between Christianity. There's not a war between Christians and science. There is a war between the Bible, Christianity, Christians, and scientism. Science on balance is good, but nothing good can be said for scientism. Oh man, I like the way he talks. Scientism adds to science. Just like the Jesus Seminar doesn't tell you what their little criteria for blackballing something is. That makes them end up saying only 3% of Mark is true. They set out to destroy it. Scientism adds to science. Isn't it slick? I'll bet you most of you came here today, you wouldn't even have paused to use science and scientism as synonyms. But there's a big difference. Scientism adds to science two corollaries. First, that the scientific method is, if not the only reliable method of getting at truth, then at least the most reliable method. In other words, all other doors are inferior as a doorway to truth. What's the second thing that scientism adds, which makes it a religion and a theology, or an ology, not a theology? They get into cosmology. Cosmology analyzes all that there is, the cosmos. All there ever was, all there ever is, and all there ever will be. So to them, their faith, when they start philosophizing, is cosmology. Metaphysics. That realm of philosophy that in its subordinate branch, ontology, deals with the reality of being. That goes beyond cosmology and ask the question which science turned into scientism disallows. How dare the metaphysician ask the question, well, cosmos, Carl Sagan, cosmos is all there ever was, all that there is, and all that there will ever be. And we dumb philosophers ask the question, are you sure there isn't something else? That turned from cosmology to metaphysics. Aren't you having fun? You can use this in foreplay. If your wife didn't come with you today, surprise her tonight with some flowers and talk metaphysics. And you remember that movie where the woman was turned on if you spoke Italian? And the lover was saying, raviola, fettuccine, spaghetti. Try metaphysics. First, what scientism adds, the scientific method is, if not the only reliable method of getting at truth, then at least the most reliable. Second, that the things science deals with, material entities, are the most fundamental things that exist. Those two things turn science into scientism. That the scientific method is, if not the only, the most reliable method of arriving at truth. So any other truth must be subjected to the eye of science, and if science doesn't pass it with its controlled experiments, it can't be embraced as truth. And that the things that science deals with, since they're the best source of truth, material things, are the most fundamental things, the most real, the only real. By suggestion, but not quite, because they accept the existence of emotions, but they believe that ultimately material things will explain all of that. Ultimately, we'll create, if you carry scientism to its logical endpoint, given enough time, somewhere, sometime. I read in the paper today, a couple of scientists are going to brave the wrath of the world in cloning a human being. And scientism believes eventually we will be able to create and punch buttons for hate, punch buttons for love, punch buttons or take pills for everything. And you are somehow an inferior being. If you don't recognize this, these two corollaries are seldom voiced. For once they're brought to attention, it's not difficult to see that they are arbitrary, unsupported by facts, at best philosophic, unproved assumptions, and at worst, merely opinions. One of Freud's assertions can head the parade. Our science is not illusion, but an illusion it would be to suppose that what science cannot give us, we can get somewhere else. That's the illusion. It's everywhere around you. The scientific world took over. I can tell that you've heard all this. Their attitude, their snide look down on you. There is probably no one in the world with an ego like an arrogant physicist. Mathematics, the purest language of reality, physics, they know everything. They can tell you how everything comes about. And without some humility, you can only control that which is inferior. Think on that. I'm just going to drop a few bombs along today. The attitude that God is having His wrath build up for. The attitude that explains the cuz, so close to a cuss and a curse, of His wrath coming on you. You can only control what's inferior. And man, as a scientist, can only examine and ultimately define and give the aura of truth to that which is inferior to it. You have to be above it to be able to define it, correl it, explain it, and project it as truth. This great other that God says you should recognize from His craftsmanship is superior. You're not going to submit or find or control Him by the scientific method. Therefore, you can't play God without eliminating Him from consciousness. You don't eliminate Him. Scientists sometimes don't even like anyone that teaches or studies in the social studies. I remember how it was in the vogue when I was doing my undergraduate work. It pushed me toward geology and geography as a minor, and a unit major ultimately to go on to a PhD. I started out doing my undergraduate degree in history and the teaching of the social sciences. We were second-class citizens on campus. The number one guys were in the area of real truth, real knowledge. You could see their nose go up when you use the phrase social scientist, because that's not science. It was a mindset that pervades. It's what you grew up in as an educational system. That's the only pure knowledge. Houston Smith tells, when I ask a scientist how he and his colleagues regarded us humanists, those who teach in the humanities, he answered affably, "We don't even bother to ignore you guys." That's the floor of knowledge. What's the wall? The left wall. Ready for this? You don't have to read it now. You got it in the bookstore? No. I'm not going to put it there. It'll be bought out of all the store before I can get there. Turn into the left wall of the tunnel. I've been telling you this for 25 years. Which is higher education. And one of his books that he reviews, which I'll skip over, the title says all that needs to be said. George M. Marsden, The Soul of the American University. He chooses this as what he calls his textbook for each section. He chose George M. Marsden's The Soul of the American University because its subtitle, From Protestant Establishment to Established Non-Belief, comes close to telling the story itself. Did you follow that? Let me read it slowly. This is what you've been victimized with. I've been telling you for 25 years. I could not get my master's teaching credential in the teaching of social sciences, which qualified me to teach the secondary and junior college level. I could not get the approval of my master teacher, under whom I had to put in a term of teaching under him. To get the general secondary credential, you had to be a student teacher working under another teacher, and they had to approve you. And I couldn't get it without adopting the method called progressive education, problem solving. Those days, there was not to be found in any, not to be found in any college below the graduate level. This is the 1950s. There was not to be found in any college below the graduate level a course in philosophy of education. It wasn't until I went to Stanford, having planned to do a PhD in geography, and was so captured by the revelation of philosophy of education that I started over without having had a philosophy class. I started over to do a PhD in philosophies of education. My major prof, Larry Thomas, was the president of American Philosophy of Education Professors and the leading exponent, as I've told you many times, of John Dewey's progressive education that dominated particularly New York and California at the time. Go back to the 50s. California, New York was among the leaders of the nation in education. Now we fall sadly behind. And the two center springs from which the spring of graduates flowed to dominate teachers' colleges and the teaching programs of this country came out of Cal and Stanford, totally committed to progressive education. Larry Thomas was the leading exponent of John Dewey's experimentalism on the West Coast. And experimentalism is the philosophy from which progressive education, a PR name, springs. And experimentalism, as I've told you many times, idealistic in epistemology, believes reality is nothing but a sea of change. There are no absolutes, except that there are no absolutes. That's the only absolute. There are no absolutes. There are no unchanging facts, except the one unchanging fact. There are no unchanging facts. Everything changes. There are no absolutes. All that matters is the life you now have, and your individuality is no more than a wave in the sea, here today and gone tomorrow. And you must maximize it. And thus the criteria of life is confronting problems, solving them to your satisfaction, to prolong as long as you can the joy of your own existence. And thus, now is of paramount importance, and me is the center of the universe, and truth is what works for me, and value is what satisfies me, and what you learn is not as important as how you learn, because what you learn will change, but the fact you must face change will never, ever change, and therefore you learn to solve problems to your satisfaction. Me, 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 me. Truth is what works for me. Truth is what makes me happy. Truth is what satisfies me. Value is the same. And this generation is its product. Higher education looked down on religion and treated it with disdain, as I've been testifying, and now he gives illustrations. What happened? Colleges and universities begin in this land to train clergymen. Remember that? Oh, as they talk about religion being totally alien to the government. We got a Bible back there the government paid for during the Revolution, the Aiken Bible. Education started to train preachers, no less, where most of the higher educational systems began. But suddenly with the change, the modern university is not agnostic toward religion. It's actively hostile to it. Younger scholars, and I felt like I was looking in the mirror, younger scholars quick, am I boring you? Younger scholars quickly learn that influential professors hold negative attitudes toward open religious expression, and that to be accepted, they should keep quiet about their faith. History helps to place this prejudice in perspective. We know that universities evolved in Europe from cloisters. The word college initially referred to cloisters of monks who needed to know how to read in order to perform their offices. And in the New World, the first colleges were primarily seminaries for training ministers. But when colleges, in the course of becoming universities, loosened or severed their church connections, they needed a new identity, a new model, if you will. And the German universities, then the most prestigious in the world, were ready at hand. And I told you how Leipzig University produced the leadership of the American Medical Association, and how John Dewey, at the State Teachers College of Columbia in New York, conquered the whole educational world. And out of that seedbed, heads of universities, I'm the only failure came out of Stanford. My second, there were three professors who guided me. I was there when Stanford was experimenting with cross-departmental degrees. I was very lucky because I then could cross-departmentalize with the religion department, philosophy department, the education department. Professor Cowley, Larry Thomas was my primary professor. Lex Miller, the New Zealand theologian who had studied under Karl Barth, the founder really of neo-orthodoxy in Germany, and had become Reinhold Niebuhr's the spokesperson primarily for it in America, Reinhold Niebuhr's assistant at Union, and he headed the religion department at Stanford. So I was able to do my dissertation on the theology of Reinhold Niebuhr. But every person who worked with Professor Cowley and with Larry Thomas went immediately from Stanford to prestige universities, and at the last count, they used to meet. I only went once, you know, but they used to meet the graduates that we all worked together and would help one another in areas of relative strengths and weakness. And every one of them was either dean, president, or an administrative head at some major university in America. One of my closest friends, last I checked, was president of Ball State University. Another one was the dean of a department at New York, one of the New York State Universities, the oldest person. I'm the only failure because I didn't go ahead in education, and I'm not heading some college. And this may interest you that don't know it. I'm the only preacher, the only pastor that was featured in a cover story article in the Stanford Alumni Magazine. I was between Margaret Thatcher and Gorbachev. Now, as I said, I'm thumbing my nose at the establishment that almost wrecked. I have great respect for Stanford. That's not what I mean by that. But this period where the academicians looked down on religion, which still prevails, though there's a little crack, as this man will see, a little light at the end of the tunnel. Germans, the anticlericalism is built into the 18th century German university, and it remains in place in the American university today. Force of habit explains this in part, but rivalry also enters the picture. Having won its autonomy from the church, the university has become the church's rival for the mind of our times, and rivals seldom have the fairest pictures of their opponents' positions. In this country, universities began to train clerics. Faith was a large part of it in universities. Europe was emerging from the Dark Ages, rebelling against the stronghold of the Catholic Church. And thus the universities moved into science and shook off as the greatest danger to their autonomy anything religious. And when that became the model for both education and the practice of medicine in this country, religion moved sideways. That's why the average mental attitude, when my PSA goes down to zero, I will hear Wrong diagnosis. Or, if I wait long enough, and you lose faith and I lose faith and it reappears, I told you so. Because a miracle cannot happen. Now, I'm a fourth of the way toward my death sentence and I don't feel very dead. Now, that I want you to see. Whoa. Thank you, but whoa. I only got a few minutes. Thank you, but whoa. This is the tunnel we grow up in. This is what your kids face. And this is what is bringing the wrath of God, because the tunnel has shut out the obvious. What's the ceiling? The roof. The media. The media. These talking heads who have been produced by the floor, who have grown up and lived in the floor, on the floor of science, scientism. Most of these talking heads get their position because of their teeth, their smile, their looks, and their age. Most of them are too young to act as wise as they do. Most of them are really. There's very few PhDs delivering these 30-minute solutions to the world's problems. Very few of them. And the media has swallowed hook, line, and sinker the premises of scientism. They are the product, what little they have, of the right wall, or whatever wall it was, the left wall. And they're the roof. Those talking heads every night are the ceiling on looking beyond. You watch their attitude. Come the holy days, you see them stumbling over trying to mix all these different religious happenings at the same time. I just saw, I don't know what I was looking at, I just happened to go by on TV. And a bunch of hippie-looking reporters. You know, these real smart kind. Were carrying microphones. And you could see the not even very much effort in concealing their disdain as they're talking to a group of Latinos who are gathered before a church window, and some are going up the stairs and reaching around and touching that church window, that they believe a picture of the Madonna, an image of the Madonna, forms occasionally and can be seen. And you can just see these reporters reeking with their skepticism as they ask questions that are such an insult, because they think that someone cannot see that they are not asking the question sincerely. You can almost see their other self is standing up there winking at their compatriots in the truck. I'm going to ask a question to make this person look like a bigger asteroid orifice than I think he is. It is as brutally ignorant to deny as it is to affirm without evidence. But scientism denies everything and only affirms what they can prove with their experiments. You close the world of sources of truth. Art, music, intuition, instinct, mystical experiences, epiphanies, faith. This is the tunnel the world has been put in to dehumanize us and make us feel like fools to even talk about the supernatural. The media, got a whole chapter on them. What's the word back here? Scientism's attitude toward humanists. What do you say? We don't even bother to ignore you guys. I'm going to slightly bother to ignore these guys by just mentioning the obvious. Talking vacant heads. Talking vacant heads. You know, on Saturday Night Live last night, sometimes they get real gross, but Saturday Night Live, there was some girl playing a part at political convention on the end of the Florida count. And of course, there was some sort of racy stuff involved. But she makes the comment, the face painter is present. Gore's face painter. It paints the faces of Gore. And the face painter wanted me to tell you that she would only paint the face of Gore on faces. Let me try that again. The face painter wants to announce to all of you that she will only paint the face of Gore on faces. Not other parts of the body. Ah, so. Well, the media's face painter have painted the wrong end of the body, and that's what we're looking at every night. And what is the right wall? What's the right wall? And he has a flagship book for that section. I'm so glad, you know, there's commentaries for centuries on Romans, and no one has fitted Smith into it because he just wrote the book. The final flagship book I shall be using, and I've chosen it for the tunnel's right wall, Scientism the floor, Higher Education the left wall, Media the ceiling, the right wall. I've chosen Stephen Carter's The Culture of Disbelief, How American Law and Politics Trivialize Religious Devotion. Carter, who teaches law at Yale University, explains that he wrote his book because he had noticed an increase in the marginalization of religion in public life during the 30 years of his career. He wanted to look into the law's role in the decline. And he told an interviewer when his book was published, in an earlier era, although there was never as healthy a respect for religious pluralism as there should have been, I do not think there was a healthy respect for what counted as religion. People might have been somewhat limited in their visions of what counted as religion, but there was no respect for it. And I think this is true right across the political spectrum and up and down the social and economic ladder. That has changed. There is less respect for religion, less of an appreciation of it as an important force that can genuinely be the motive force in people's lives without being somehow a symptom of something neurotic. That's what's been lost. I don't really think I have to elaborate when that giraffe made of parts of strange other animals, Janet Reno, comes flat out saying that people who take the Bible as their guide and named a series of habits normal for Christianity in America for centuries. And she defined those habits as qualifying as a cult. The woman that would call the shots at Waco, when that jerk could have been arrested any day of the week, as he wandered around, and all the crazy explanations of it, the law has lost respect for religion and trivialized it. And they no longer, in fact, Scalia, in his opinion on reversing Congress's attempt to bring the courts and the law back in line, that only with a compelling state interest can invasion be made into churches. In Indianapolis today, the ATF is ringed around a Baptist church pastored by Dr. Greg Dixon in his 70s. The local enforcement would not even act. The marshal was ordered by a judge to take the church over. And he handed in his badge. All because this church took the position, God advised them, I told them to not make the mistake that the church that I came to made a few years ago. Form a separate tax-paying corporation and hire your teachers out of that and pay them. But the integrity of this pastor is unchallengeable. He had a Christian school. He paid the teachers as independent contractors, and they paid taxes. That's all been proven. He said that the government could not make a church collect its taxes from the employees. And he drew a line. And what turned out to be somewhere around $300,000 in what they assessed as back taxes by penalties turned into $3 or $4 million. And this is reminiscence of Hartford. Remember when they seized the tower? When they told me, because of some mistakes of my predecessors, they were going to seize the property. And I said, my dead body and a communion table. We won because of a willingness to pay whatever price was necessary to learn and fight the legal battles that resulted in the Petras Bill that changed the law here in California. But for weeks, going on months, 2,000-3,000 people have been sitting in that church. The parsonage already been seized. And the ATF is just waiting them out because they say they don't want to have another Waco, to collect taxes from this church that they say should have collected taxes on their teachers as employees, so the employer portion is a little larger amount of tax, when these teachers were treated as self-employed and each of the teachers, it's been proven, paid their own taxes. Without taking sides, you think President Jefferson or George Washington or Abraham Lincoln would have allowed an attorney general that would be better as a picket fence than a judicial dignitary to okay something of the nature of Waco? I do not speak for Waco. The man was a nut. The price of freedom is association with nuts. We all know the history of the persecution of the Mormons. Now, you only have to see the influence of Senator Orrin Hatch to realize something changed. But it didn't change because of a respect for religion. They changed because they were smart enough to get enough money to hold their own with anybody. Law closed the world in until the wrath of God deserved is falling on a world that has turned on God and have such silly attitudes. And I close with this as we now move to the consequences of this state of mind in next Sunday's message of what God turns them over to. I must read this to you, if I can find it. I got it written down over here, so I'll find the page. You going to stay with me as I finish this? Page 56. I noted it. Here is a typical attitude of the ungodly and the unrighteous. Parents, yuppie parents, this generation, look in the mirror, those particularly listening to me. It's from Stephen Dunn's work at the Smithville Methodist Church, the attitude of parents who live in the tunnel, scientism, higher education product, the media, the law, that suggest all the time that a belief in the supernatural or a great other is a sign that you've got some mental deficiencies or a psychotic connection to some warped traditional view. These parents let their kid go to this. They let their little girl go. This is their attitude. It was supposed to be arts and crafts for a week. I sent my little girl to it. But when she came home with the Jesus Saves button, we knew what art was up, what ancient craft. She liked her little friends. She liked the songs that they sang when they weren't twisting and folding paper into dolls. What could be so bad? Jesus had been a good man. And putting faith in good men was what we had to do to stay this side of cynicism, that other sadness. Okay, we said, 1 week. But when she came home singing, "Jesus loves me, the Bible tells me so," it was time to talk. Could we say Jesus doesn't love you? Could I tell her the Bible is a great book certain people use to make you feel bad? No, we sent her back without a word. It had been so long since we believed, so long since we needed Jesus as our nemesis and friend, that we thought he was sufficiently dead, that our children would think of him like Lincoln or Thomas Jefferson. Soon it became clear to us, and this is why you're without excuse. Soon it became clear to us, you cannot teach disbelief to a child. Only wonderful stories. And we hadn't a story. We had no story nearly as good. On Parents' Night, there were the arts and crafts all spread out like appetizers. Then we took our seats in the church, and the children sang a song about the ark, and hallelujah, and in one in which they had to jump up and down for Jesus. I can't ever remember ever feeling so uncertain about what's comic and what's serious. Evolution is magical, but devoid of heroes. You can't say to your child, "Evolution loves you." The story stinks of extinction and nothing exciting happens for centuries. I didn't have a wonderful story for my child. And she was beaming. All the way home in the car, she sang the songs, occasionally standing up for Jesus. There was nothing to do but drive, write it out, sing along in silence. Because having known God, they glorified, gave Him glory and worship, not as God, nor thanked Him, but became vain, empty, self-deceived, in the reasonings, arguments, and dialogues of them, and their senseless heart was darkened. God fed up with all this idiocy that builds a tunnel so small when God spoke the universes, the magna and the micro, the macro and the micro. And we want to stick our head up in this tunnel and say, this is all there ever was, all it is, and all there ever will be. And the wrath of God begins on those now and has been happening. You choose that tunnel over the evidences of God, obvious. You don't have to wait for hell. The wrath of God will go to work on you right now and push you into what the next messages describe as the horrors of a life turned over by God. Small wonder Paul was impassioned, and we are impassioned, to get the good news of the gospel out, that there is the great other who cared enough to blast open the tunnel, whatever it was, in the fullness of time, and move onto the stage of history and provide the rescue effort. Thank God I can preach it with the knowledge, not just speculation, that there is a God who can intrude and respond to faith. Every day now, more than ever before, I want to give Him glory for what is just the air we breathe. And God doesn't like it that we're not thankful. For every day when I wake up now, I've learned a new thankfulness. Thanksgiving for the light, the people that are the primary object of this message, as Paul preached it, didn't have the light we have. And yet they're the subject of God's wrath, object and subject, because He pushes them into it. And they become what they want to be. Free of Him. Free of the rescue. Thanks be to God. He found us. And He's with us. And He redeemed us. And for simple trust, He takes us out of this mess. And beyond the tunnel. What's good about it? We won't even have to see Him, because the media is the ceiling and we'll be above it. That's my message.
amazed. Zing, grace. Well, give me your key. Give me your key. You mean I found your key? Melissa? Amazing. I think we ought to sing this song. Melissa and I and the band and all of you. Because what we have described in these messages is what God's delivered you from if you've responded in faith. Amazing grace. That's what I want to ring out as we close the service. Ushers will come. It's offering time. Now that my wife is here, she can sing the first bar. Hit the key.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
I once was lost, but now I'm found. I don't want the rhythm. I don't want any beat. I was blind, but now I see. See, I don't want any rhythm on this verse because I want them to hear the words. Sing it again. Just whisper it for yourself.
How sweet the sound that a wretch like me.
This is our testimony. I once was lost, but now I'm found.
Was blind, but now I see.
Now hit it. Now you can sing. Whoa! I want that third verse now. Through many dangers.
Through many dangers.
How many can say that's true? Toil.
Toil and snares I have already come.
'Tis grace that brought all of us safe thus far. And grace will lead us home. Go, 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 go. How's this for getting out of the tunnel? When we've been there 10,000 years.
When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun.
Think of it. We've no less days to sing thanksgiving, God's praise, than when
we first begun.
Go. Now you're getting into it.
I say, oh,
now?
What now?
Let's hear that last verse again. When we've been there 10,000, 10 years, bright shining.